Maine's June primary is drawing near, and today we bring you another in our series of Your Vote 2018 interviews with the candidates vying for their party's nominations in the race for governor and 2nd District Congressional seat. In this series, we'll hear from all 14 primary candidates on a range of key issues. We'll also find out why each believes that they're the best choice to represent their party in the general election this fall. If you miss either of our candidate interviews in this hour, you can hear all 14 conversations at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You can also learn more about each of the candidates and see their positions broken down on an easy-to-use issues grid near the top of our Your Vote 2018 page. Today we'll hear from two gubernatorial hopefuls, Republican Sean Moody and Democrat Mark Dion. Moody founded Moody's Collision Centers, a Maine chain of auto body repair shops. In 2010, he ran unsuccessfully for governor as an unenrolled candidate. Moody graduated from Gorham High School and told Maine Public's Mal Leary that he's the only Republican in the race who's been managing a business for 40 years.
So I think that's a big difference. You know, healthcare costs go up. We have to put in wellness, you know, programs into place, HSA programs. We actually became self-insured this year because our healthcare premiums are going to crest $1 million now. So, you know, we experience the policies that are driven from Augusta in our business, in our personal lives. And everybody I talk to out there, they want someone that's a grounded, that's a Mainer, that's been in business, got a good track record to solve some of the state's challenges, because I've been experiencing government like them, you know, from the top down.
What's the biggest challenge facing Maine, and what could you do as governor to address it?
I think it's twofold. Number one, you know, we've got to continue to be fiscal managers. I think Governor LePage has done a good job getting our fiscal house in order. He paid off the hospitals, which is $750 million. He's got the unemployment rate has gone down. I mean, that's not all obviously the governor's doing, but the national economy has improved. So we're down to what you could call basically full employment. So we get some positive things happen here in Maine economically, and we've got to continue to keep our costs down, look at ways that we can kind of reduce the size and the scope of the state government. But at the same time, grow our economy, you know, continue to, in some areas of state now, there's not enough people to do the work. And other areas need more businesses that provide good paying jobs. And I've traveled the whole state, and I know the difference between the two. So I think I would start a kind of a migration, not immigration, but migration strategy to bring former Mainers back to the state of Maine and reunite their families and revitalize our rural communities, because people need talent. And so we can get the 25 to 45-year-old former Mainers come back here and raise their families here in the state of Maine. We could offer tuition reimbursement if they want to continue their education, student loan forgiveness programs. I think the governor's got a bill now to try to put a bond in to do something to that effect. I think that's critical. We just can't let this population decline and our aging demographic. Those are the two critical areas that we need to address.
You've touched on this, but the polls continue to show that jobs are the biggest concern, even though we've got pretty low unemployment right now. What could you do as governor to improve the economy?
Well, we're 48th in business friendly. You look at New Hampshire now, and New Hampshire is very pro-business. And I'm not saying geographically they're much smaller state than we are. So I'm not. It's a little bit of an apple-orange comparison. But the bottom line is, I'll give you an example. When I started my business at 17, I went down to the town office and took out a building permit. It was $35, and we started the job the next day. We're siting a new shop in South Portland right now. Permits, fees, and approvals, it will cost $60,000, and it will take longer to permit the project than it will actually to build it. So, again, I've been in 11 communities across the state in front of appeals board, planning boards, dealt with the DEP, the EPA, the Army Corps of Engineers. We've permitted so many projects and built so many buildings, businesses. We know what needs to happen to ease the regulatory burden and the tax burden and just reinvigorate and reignite our small business community, small business startups, because that's what Maine is. Most of Maine's businesses are 20 people or less, 90%. And that's who I am. I'm a small business entrepreneur, and I know what they need to grow, and I know what they need to get started. We got to get government to be a willing partner, not an inhibitor.
As you know, Maine voters will use ranked choice voting for the first time in this primary. We don't know how the courts are going to rule on the Republican Party challenge, so it's quite possible that you're going to have to decide how you're going to rank, and assuming you're going to rank yourself as number one, who's your number two, number three, number four?
Well, that's a good assumption, number one, Mal. I would say, me personally, I'm just going to go in and mark one vote for the candidate. You know, here's a great thing about America and freedom and liberty. Nobody can force you to use this system. I am absolutely opposed to ranked choice voting. It's confusing. It's contentious. It's another example of the referendum process. You know, I call them out-of-state legislative vigilantes have come in here with out-of-state money, and they're reshaping our state right before our eyes. And I'm opposed to it. But I would say to all the listeners out there, just go in and vote for the candidate like you normally would. One vote, one candidate.
Nationally, Maine ranks relatively low in its rate of gun violence, but nearly half of domestic violence homicides in this state involve guns. Should Maine gun laws be changed, and if so, how?
I am a staunch supporter of the Second Amendment, and I think a lot of people connect the Second Amendment to, you know, hunting and, you know, handguns and things like that. Really, the Second Amendment was put in place so people could defend and protect their property against a tyrannical government, which may sound like a far-fetched thing 200 years later, but the banks collapsed in 2008, and they were actually run on some of the banks here in this country. So it's not as far-fetched as some people may like it out to be. So I'm a supporter of the Second Amendment and our constitutional rights, but I would be an advocate and a champion to tackle one of the biggest concerns and the biggest social problems that we have here in the state of Maine is our mental health system. You know, we went from one extreme to the other. We went from institutions back in the 60s and 70s, like AMI, for example, to mostly outpatient clinics. And what's the intermediary now has become our jails and our law enforcement system and our school systems. And they just can't continue to try to fill this vacuum created by that shift.
Let's go back to the gun violence question, though, because one of the ideas that's been proposed, it's pending in the legislature, is the so-called red flag clause that go to the issue you're talking about, and that is somebody who is mentally unstable. The law enforcement community can go to a judge and say, we think this person is dangerous and we should take their gun away from them. Is that the sort of gun control that you see is possible and maybe the way to go?
You know, I don't, Mal. Let's go to Florida, for example. Talk about red flags. There were tons of red flags that went up, right? And I think everybody did what they should. They alerted the proper authorities. There was, you know, law enforcement went to this man's house 23 times. And yet he wasn't, you know, incarcerated or they did not deal with him as a threat that it turned out to be. And God, that happened. You know, I can't believe it. I think Maine law enforcement, our school systems, our teachers, you know, students have done a great job in alerting people. And we've, you know, you've seen it, Mal. We've shut schools down because of social media threats and things like that and acted upon those threats. That's the key, to be responsive, to act upon the threats, to be ever diligent and aware. So I wholeheartedly believe that our mental health system is tattered, you know, and we need to reconstruct it in a way that meets and serves the needs of the people that are in crisis, to get them on a pathway to stability.
Maine is currently enjoying a low unemployment rate, one of the lowest we've ever had, but we still rank 44th nationally on median household income. So the question is, how would you help Maine workers earn more?
Well, I think it's happening now, Mal. You know, it never happens fast enough, but the reality is wages are starting to come up finally starting to come up, and thank God, because the cost of living continues to rise at a pace that's, you know, we're seeing gas now approaching $3 a gallon. And no, I think that one of the biggest things I want to point out, Mal, though, is my background in blue collar in the trades. I think this is an opportunity to elect a governor that understands being a craftsman, the blue collar trades, and we could revamp our current CTE and vocational programs to be the best in the country. And why that's critical, you can't find tradespeople now. You know, they're retiring out, and we don't have enough people to do, try to find a carpenter or a plumber or HVAC technician. So we need to be diligent about having people go and aspire to higher ed. I'm on both boards. The only person to serve in that capacity in the state's history, the university system and the community college board. Now, those two boards are working together at a level never seen before. But also, you know, I've got the other side. I've got the blue-collar hat, to say 40 to 50% of those students that aren't college bound, whether it's a family issue, financial issue, We've got to teach them the skills and the trade so they can go out there and earn a great living, you know, buy a home, raise a family, and earn $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, not just scrape by, because the best pathway out of poverty or welfare is the skills and earn a trade, and that's the path to prosperity, because I'm a living example of that.
Maine's currently one of the most expensive states for electricity, although we're still the lowest in New England. What, as governor, what could you do to try to lower those rates?
Well, I think we got to take a hard look at distribution cost. You know, they deregulated the energy production 4 or 5 years ago, and you've seen that the costs go down in those areas because of increased competition. But as those prices have gone down, delivery distribution costs have gone up. So we're still paying, you know, 14 or 15 cents a kilowatt, which is, you know, 20% higher than I think it should be or could be. If we deregulate the distribution here in the state, and I know it's going to be controversial to say that, but I don't see any other option. The other thing that it stands in the way of, our regulatory environment stands in the way of a lot of cogeneration. You know, the University of Maine at Farmington, for example, being on the board, we did a coal fuel plant up there, $14 million project, that heats the entire campus in through biomass. But it also has the ability to go on natural gas, too, because fuel's a commodity. Energy is a commodity. And if you can't meet the market to drive the prices down, that's what's standing in the way, because Maine generates more electricity than we consume. So if you look at that with a straight face, it's like, how can that be? If we've got more supply than demand, why are the prices so high?
A lot's been made about attracting businesses to Maine. You've made it one of the key things in your campaign. But how do we do that? Because some believe that the tax breaks we've been giving really don't help the process, that you end up with giving a tax incentive that doesn't really generate the jobs it's supposed to. What are your thoughts on going after those tax incentives?
I think you really got to look at them on a case-by-case business basis. And again, I'm a private capital guy, a free market guy, and I believe that small business is the backbone of the state. It's the backbone of the country. And I think the regulatory environment, you know, it's a lot about attitude. When I was in front of the Maine Municipal Association, I said, you know, you could just say one thing, it wouldn't cost you a dime, is that when someone goes through the burden of expanding their business and the approvals and the cost and everything else, just have the planning board chair or the town council chair say, look, Mal, you know, we know we've run you through the ringer. We wanted a good quality project here, but we do appreciate you being here in the town and providing jobs for our local community. It's just the attitude you get when you have to go through these rigorous and expensive processes to expand that makes you feel like, I'm sure there's a lot of people that throw their hands up and don't do it. They just say, you know what, it's not worth jumping through these hoops and hurdles. So being a business person, knowing what that feels like, and knowing when you're going home at night thinking you got, you know, beat up and sent home, would change the attitude. And business confidence is like consumer confidence. If you get a business person in the Blaine House, okay, businesses are going to know you got their back. And we got to continue that attitude. I think the governor has established that attitude, and we got to continue that to help grow Maine's economy and encourage young people to start their own business. Like I said, you know, $35 with a permit or $60,000. You wonder why more people aren't expanding and growing their business here in the state of Maine. That's why.
What about Maine's welfare system? Some folks think it's too generous. Some think there are too many people falling through the safety net. What would you do to change it if you would change it at all?
Number one, we have the mental health issues that we need to tackle to get people to make sure we have a stable mental health system and stable people with mental health illness. And also the trades. I think that's another key component. If you've got 40% of our student population that's not going on to college and they're not taught skills in a trade, how are they going to go out there and really, you know, prosper and aspire in Maine's economy? It's stacked against them. So they're going to be stuck minimum wage jobs, in and out of poverty. And if it's more lucrative for them to sit home and make more money, you know, human nature, unfortunately, they're going to choose to do that. So we would create a mezzanine for them now, teach them some skills, a trade, and that way they don't lose all the benefits. You know, where it is right now, it's a cliff. It's either all or nothing. And we've got to make it so that they can kind of walk their way, step their way back into a normal, productive, and dignified life.
Voters overwhelmingly approved expanding Medicaid at the polls last year, yet the legislature and the governor have been at odds over how to fund it. Do you support Medicaid expansion? And if so, how would you pay for it as governor?
A twofold question. Number one, no, I did not support it. I just feel strongly that, you know, the governor just paid off the hospitals a couple years ago, $750 million commitment, okay, to pay that bill. And here we are going right back to the same design. And my feeling is, again, we don't have enough competition here in the state of Maine for health care insurance. We only get really two or three predominant health care providers. So we need to lower the cost. Not many people talk about lowering the cost of health care. And that's what we need to focus on, have more transparency. So when you actually go to get a procedure, not an emergency procedure, but you ought to get a list up front, like a quote, call it what you want. What is this going to cost me to have the MRI, to have the X-ray, to have the procedure done? And then you can shop. Right now, the consumer is completely blocked out of cost. You don't go grocery shopping with nothing priced out and then show up at the checkout aisle and find out, you know, meat's $12 a pound, whatever it is. So we need to make it transparent so consumers can make choices. So Medicaid expansion, I think, is just a way to fund the Affordable Care Act, which is failing in and of itself. And in terms of what we need to do to lower health care costs here in the state of Maine, transparency, reduce waste, get rid of the frivolous lawsuits. I mean, we got to get serious about it.
Does the state pay its fair share of local education costs? And if not, how much should it pay?
We're educating our children and young adults to go out into a highly competitive global economic environment. And education is static, is not dynamic. So we need to change K-12 education to become more of a dynamic environment. And how we do that is we can take a lot of administrative cost, redundancies, out at the local level. And how we do that is we set the example at the state level. We got to lead by example. We took $80 million out of the University of Maine system cost by back office, consolidating back office functions and administration. And we can do that across state government. So we need to look at K-12 and how do we deliver that education? How do we get the dollars to the educators, the teachers that are actually providing the education to the students in the classroom? And we've got way too much administrative overhead. Trust me, we've got 11 locations now. So I'm talking from experience. This isn't like anecdotal. And we've got one office in Gorham that handles our HR, our payroll, our administration, our ESOP. All the back office functions. We don't have an accountant or a bookkeeper at each location. We don't have 11 bookkeepers. We don't have 11 HR directors. So we do it in private practice. And guess what? The business that we're in, the collision repair business, Maine auto insurance is the cheapest in the state of Maine as it is in the whole country. So the people out there listening are the benefactors of us keeping our costs down and delivering a quality service to the customer.
A related question to what you're talking about in terms of school funding is the teacher shortage. A lot of people are not going into teaching in part because they're not getting paid competitive to other professions. How would you address that problem?
I 100% believe in performance pay for teachers. So when you give educators across-the-board pay raises, that just breeds mediocrity. Because the people that are really doing the job, they're doing it because they want to do it. It's not financial to them. They have a passion for it. But the people that aren't getting the job done, there's no comprehensive way to evaluate that on an individual basis. And it's got to be fair. It's got to be a principal, some educators, you know, a peer group that's fair and that's objective. We've done it, like I say, for 25 years. Now, compensation is based on performance, so your best teachers are getting the best pay, and they should. They deserve it. They earn it. And the people that are maybe not passionate about education anymore, it just become a job to them, they'll move. You'll liberate them, and then go out and find a job that they are passionate about. And the students benefit, and the educators benefit, because I'll tell you why. If an educator leaves public education and goes into the private world, I don't care if it's IDEX Labs, or if they work in a small, you know, smaller business, but a best-in-class business, I will promise you that they will be evaluated on a performance basis. So to me, if you're grading the student, right, you got the teacher's grading the student in the classroom, I think it's a double standard that educator is not graded in a fair and responsible way that can help them to aspire share best practices, improve. So if educators improve individually, the system will improve collectively. So back to your point, morale's down, a lot of turnover. Some of that's because of the social issues that are going on, the family units breaking down, and teachers have extraordinary pressures on them in the classroom, extraordinary. And that's what's taking its toll. So I would put back a process like we have at Moody's, the best places to work, where you survey the people doing the job and you find out from them, what do we need to do to improve your environment in the classroom so you can do a better job? It's got to happen at the teacher level, not through four or five layers of bureaucracy. That's where the message gets convoluted.
In response to an earlier question, you were critical of the referendum process.
Yes.
How would you fix it?
Well, I think that the first two things need to happen. Number one, stop paying people to get signatures. You know, I think that right there is allows out-of-state money to come in and influence. I heard, again, I'm not a big rumor guy, but I've heard, you could verify it, Mel, but people getting paid, you know, $8 or $10 a signature. I mean, that's and people getting harassed, you know, coming out of the supermarket or just trying to go about their daily lives. People are harassing them because they're getting paid and they're caring about their own pocketbook. So eliminate that. If you're passionate about a cause, you'll get out there, bang on the doors, and you know, you can get the signatures because it's something you care about. And the second, rural Maine is getting left out. You know, these referendums are being driven from, you know, Portland, you know, Lewiston, are highly densely populated areas of the state. And so I think we should do it by district so that the first and second district are equally represented. The second district's getting blanked out. And I've said, I'm going to fight to keep Maine, Maine, because if this process keeps going, it's looking more like California. That's just, to me, it can't happen.
We're hearing a lot of pundits talk about this country growing so polarized that elected officials keep trying to keep their supporters happy, the people that nominate them, elect them, instead of trying to compromise and settle and solve issues. Do you think that's true? And if it is going on, how do you address it?
I think if you have the leadership capabilities and experience, you can build consensus. Now, there's two ways to do that. There's an old saying that you can sell it or you can tell it. Sell your idea, which is enthusiasm and encouragement and charisma, whatever, and that's one way. Then there's to tell it. Tell it means you got to have the facts, the data, and the analysis to back up to show what are the benefits going to be to if we implement this initiative or this outcome that we're looking for to move forward. I think you can do a combination of those two things. But, Mal, again, we know how to build a culture. That's what we've done in our private practice. You know, we've been gotten best places to work in Maine, the Governor's Award for Excellence in Business. We've been recognized not just statewide but nationally, internationally. Acclaimed. We've been an environmental leader by the DEP. So we've got a broad spectrum of support out there. So what I would say to the folks out there listening is I know how to get things done, and I know how to build consensus around ideas that are going to work for the Maine people, long-term ideas. I don't care about the next election, all right? I'm running because I care about the next generation. And we've blocked out our young people. We should allow them to go to work, the ones that aren't involved with extracurricular activities or, you know, in school. Get our teenagers back in the local community, a local economy, so they can learn some financial literacy, waiting on customers, dealing with adults other than their parents and teachers. You know, we need to look at what made Maine what it is today. You know, we're building ships. You know, we're building roads and bridges and rebuilding and fixing. We don't have enough people that can do those things anymore, and I'm going to focus on restoring the pride in the trades, as well as aspiring to go on to get a two-year or four-year degree. We need both, and we've really blocked out that blue-collar economy.
Candidates for governor often talk about transparency in government and how important it is for people to know what their government is up to. That's pretty different from your business background. So how would you address that issue?
I'm so glad you asked this question, Mal. Again, back in the 90s, and again, I didn't go to Harvard Business School, but I just know people, and I know what they want, and I know what they need. We didn't even know what it was called back then, open book management. So we literally, okay, this is back in the 90s, we literally, once a quarter, everybody at that particular location sits down at profit sharing meeting, looks at what our revenue, our profit, our key performance indicators. It lists down our receivables, our customer satisfaction index. We could take an 18-year-old apprentice, first day on the job, depending on where we hired them, could be looking at all of that information, full disclosure. And then we turn around and we give our coworkers at that location 10% of our after-tax profits back to them in the form of profit sharing. This first quarter, we paid out over $100,000 in profit sharing back to our coworkers. So we would have the most transparent government that you've ever seen, because that's just who I am and the way we operate. We've been doing it for over 20 years. Now, what's the benefits of that? If people know what's going on and why, all of a sudden, again, building consensus, that builds trust, that builds respect. And those are the things that people need to see if they're going to get on board.
Besides signing bills into law, which is one of the principal things that governors do, how can a governor improve the lives of Mainers?
I think you lead by example. You know, I said something controversial at the Republican convention. I said, you know, we want to drug test people that are receiving welfare benefits. If that's the case, I'm going to take a drug test, and I want every elected official to take one too. Well, people don't like to hear that. The elected officials don't like to hear that. But that's what I feel so strongly. It's like, if we're not going to have special privileges or any of these other things, we're going to lead by example. And I think it's 100% the governor's responsibility to take care of all the people. And that's a heavy burden to bear. And I will take it serious, because it's a huge responsibility. But I'm confident now that everything I've ever gotten involved with in my life has showed positive outcomes and positive forward motion, whether it's in education, in a private practice, or in my own home family life. We've been married over 30 years. My wife, Chrissy, we've got four wonderful young adults, two beautiful granddaughters, lived in my hometown, grew up there. So we've walked the walk, and that's what we need. We need to be a leader that young people can aspire to be. Be a good role model. I think that's critical.
Mainers receive failing grades for our infrastructure, both roads and bridges, our internet infrastructure. What can you do as governor to put a bipartisan plan together to address all of these problems?
You know, I think Mainers in general have been very generous with bond proposals. But again, you take it back to Governor LePage. When he took office, we had like a $1.2 billion structural gap. I mean, the finances of the state, I think people forget several years ago what kind of shape we were in. We were in tough shape. And he was disciplined, which that's what business people are. They're disciplined on making decisions. Held off until we got a bond credit rating back where it belonged, paid off the hospitals, got our fiscal house in order. So I think we're catching up now. It's never quick enough, right? People out there arriving on the roads right now going, what the heck? You know, Main Street's all torn up. But Dave Bernhardt at the DOT has a work plan. So he's actually got an actual plan that knows what the deficiencies are and the funding needs to be. And I think probably $150 million in that area deficient right now. But I think there'll be another bond proposal coming forward. I wouldn't be surprised in the fall. Mainers have been generous in that regard. We've got to continue that. We have to prioritize our infrastructure spending. And that's what usually gets cut at the local level. Let's not just all look at what's happening at the state level. These local communities, I'm in Gorham, and when you get some pressure on the mill rate, first thing you do, let's cut maintenance and let's cut roads and bridges. And that chicken's coming home to roost.
But can we get by with just bonding? Because the fundamental source of roads and bridges, for example, is the gasoline tax. And you and I are both driving far right. more efficient cars than we were 20 years ago.
Yeah, and I expect that trend to continue, Mal. I would look, and you heard me say it earlier, about the education system. We get all this redundancy and overhead. The same is true with our transportation system. We've got a Maine Turnpike Authority. New Hampshire doesn't have a quasi-government turnpike authority. It's one, and that's what we need to do here. If we merge that MTA into the DOT, I can see $30, $40 million in cost savings there. Now, how do you do that? You don't compromise the integrity or the quality or the maintenance of the road, right? You don't sell the plow trucks and do that. But you've got physical buildings that house administrators. One building's $14 million, and it was newly constructed 4 or 5 years ago. And we've got maintenance facilities that are redundant that we could use. And turn those, take that, the state inventory of brick and mortar, and turn it back over into the private tax rolls. Again, our local communities are feeling the pinch on property taxes are going up terrible. And if you take some of the state physical inventory and roll that back over onto the property tax rolls, It's a win-win. It really is. So people got to bear in mind here, okay, we run a lean, okay, quality operation. So I'm not just talking off the cuff. I mean, we know how to run efficiently. And if you think about lean and Six Sigma and the Toyota way, is all generated from the automobile industry on how to be efficient, how to operate effectively and efficiently. And that's where those savings are that we can take and reinvest into our infrastructure, which really needs it. We got to have safe roads and bridges.
This is going to be a tough one. In 60 seconds.
You mean these other ones weren't?
In 60 seconds, what are Maine's three greatest assets, and how would you leverage them to help grow Maine's economy?
People, and people. They really are. I mean, human financial capital follows human capital. And that's what we've done, Mal. Over the last 10 years or more, two things have occurred. One, okay, if it's guidance counselors, parents, teachers out there, have been telling our young adults, there's no future, there's no opportunity here in the state of Maine. It's simply not true. So we need to change that message, keep our young people here. And again, if someone wants to go tackle the world, go for it. You know, I'm all for chasing your dreams. But there are so many opportunities here in the state of Maine with our aging demographic. These are leadership positions, highly compensated positions. You're going to retire right now at some point. I will. I mean, we're at that age where it's going to take a lot of good young people to get engaged now, to learn what they need to learn in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, so they can step into these supervisory and leadership positions. That's the people are the greatest asset here in the state of Maine. The other greatest asset we have is we have one of the most beautiful states in the world. You know, you look at the mountains, the ocean, we have 3,000 miles of coastline. It's incredible. The four seasons. I love Maine. We get 20 or 30 million people come here, save their money all year long just to experience Maine for a week or two. You can't tell me we can't capture a percentage of those people coming here. So we've been named the best places to work in Maine. We're going to make Maine the best place to work in America and kind of have a hybrid, not only just, you know, Maine the way life should be, the people come up here and vacation and play, but create the environment they want to come work and spend the rest of their life here. That's what I would bring as governor.
Sean Moody, one of four Republicans vying for a chance at the Blaine House this fall. He spoke with Maine Public's Mal Leary in our series of Your Vote candidate interviews. Up next, Mark Dion was a Portland police officer who was first elected Cumberland County Sheriff in 1998 and served in that post until 2016. Dion earned a bachelor's in criminology from what is now the University of Southern Maine, a master's degree from Antioch College, and a law degree from the University of Maine School of Law. He was elected to the Maine House in 2010, where he served three terms. He was elected 2 years ago to the Maine Senate, where he continues to serve. He told Maine Public's Erwin Gratz that he's the only candidate in the race focused on creating a community health care system.
That will allow higher access by citizens. It would provide a competitive choice as opposed to corporate medicine or hospital-based services, and also help reinforce our capacity to provide service to the elders in our community who want to age at home, who have been isolated. And I think really that is the most critical policy question for us in the next decade. There's a lot of time talking about the opiate crisis, but I think the real tsunami that we have to deal with is the fact that we are an aging population, and what's our response?
What's the biggest challenge that's facing Maine, and what would you do as governor to respond to it?
The biggest challenge to Maine is, well, there are a number of challenges. I wish it could be isolated to one, but fundamentally, I think we have to do something in the legislature in order to make it a more effective institution. And I think it's important for a governor to be a bridge builder, to work in collaboration with the legislature, and to do whatever he can to broker results that make sense and answer the needs and interests of the population.
Polls continue to show that jobs are the biggest concern for voters in the state. What would you do as governor to help grow the state's economy?
I think one of the key issues around the economy is, for a long time, we've sent message to our youth that success is defined by a baccalaureate degree. I think we might have made a mistake there. I think we need to reemphasize the value of technical education, vocational education, and I want to see a commitment from Augusta to underwrite that experience so that young people will elect a path to the trades. And those are the jobs that sustain a community. There are enough lawyers in the world, but there are not enough pipe fitters or electricians or skilled carpenters. And I think that's the sector of the economy that builds small businesses. And those, in fact, are the strongest strands in the local tapestry of an economy.
As you know, Maine voters are going to be using ranked choice voting in this primary. Assuming that when you go to the polls, you'll rank yourself as the top choice, who will be your second choice and why?
You know, I've been asked that. That's really tough. As I do these forums with my colleagues, I vary. Sometimes I walk out and I say, Mark Eaves was really on point tonight. And sometimes I think Janet Mills provides a steady hand at the till in terms of where we might go forward. So right now, I'd have to say I remain undecided, but I'm torn between Mark Eaves and Janet Mills as my second choice.
All right. Nationally, Maine ranks relatively low in its rate of gun violence, but nearly half of domestic violence homicides in this state do involve guns. Should Maine's gun laws be changed, and if so, how?
I've been working on that for 8 years as a legislator. I was successful in passing a universal background check bill with Republican support that was defeated in the governor's office, but it doesn't mean it wasn't the right policy, and I hope to revisit that issue as a governor. Currently, I have pending a red flag bill to separate people who might be on a disastrous trajectory to some act of violence. And as I've suggested to my colleagues in the legislature, it's not always violence directed at another, but it could be self-inflicted violence. Maine has a very high rate of suicide by firearm, and families have been frustrated in their attempts to divide the person in crisis from access to weapons. So I think we can't just define it as gun violence against third parties, but the kind of violence that occurs in a family. And we have laws under the domestic violence heading to deal with that, but we need to have other laws that allow family members to reach out to others in order to prevent that kind of tragedy.
You know, we were talking before about jobs. Maine currently does have a very low unemployment rate, but it ranks 44th nationally in median household income. How would you help Mainers earn more money?
I think a governor can provide leadership to speak about this issue. It's funny, politicians enjoy economy on an upswing and deny any responsibility on the downswing. I think it goes back to what I said earlier. We have to stop chasing what I call the big box solution, that somehow some major employer is going to come to Maine and offer 200 or 300 jobs. I think we need to do what we can to work with municipalities to provide economic development, even at the micro level. If a person can start a business with 3 or 4 individuals, that will raise the economy. It won't be dramatic. And as I've often said, when it comes to investment in the economy, an overnight success takes about 5 years. But I think we need to focus on sectors that are closest to the neighborhood, and those are small businesses.
Maine is one of the more expensive states for electricity customers, although its rates are the lowest in New England. Is there anything you would do as governor that you think could lower electric costs?
I think we need to focus on transmission and delivery. The cost of an electron is, as you said, quite low and affordable, but moving an electron from point A to point B, the cost is high. And I think we need to have a more aggressive public utilities commission. As governor, I would expand the commission to 5 and include someone as a consumer advocate to take a look at those costs. But the other piece that Maine citizens have to recognize is Maine is a minority partner, minority shareholder in a regional electricity grid called ISO New England. And I think governors need to recognize that regional influence and assign an energy advocate to that board and argue for governance that would give Maine a better position as we make those decisions on the grid. The reality of the cost of electricity isn't dictated in Augusta. It's actually resolved in Boston. So we have to have a relationship with the Commonwealth and the state of Connecticut in order to reduce the actual cost of transmission of electrons.
Where does solar and wind fit in this picture for you?
I believe in renewables. I've advocated for it on the Energy Committee, where I've served for 6 years and chaired it. I think the frustration for the average citizen is when they see a wind tower, that electricity isn't going to their home. It's being sold to the markets in Massachusetts and Connecticut and Rhode Island. And that's where I believe in distributed generation. I think we need to create islands where power is created and sent out locally. That way we can reduce our reliance on the grid. And if the grid should go down, and we've seen how it can through weather, then those islands can pick up the slack and maintain some presence of electricity for consumers.
A lot has been made over the years about attracting businesses to Maine. Some believe tax incentives are one way to do that. Do you see those programs as effective economic development tools or as corporate welfare?
For the most part, I think citizens see it as corporate welfare. Again, we're chasing the big box and doing everything we can to get it here. I'd rather divert those monies locally. What I would do for that level of corporate activity is we need a road system that makes sense. There's a lot of talk about broadband. It's sophisticated. It's attractive. But the reality is you can order products via broadband, but you have to have a transportation system that allows you to get the goods from Maine to somewhere else. And it's difficult enough as it is to get Maine's transported within the state. So I will make an investment and develop a new financing plan so that we can invest in roads, because right now all we do with our bond strategy is keep our nose just above the waterline maintaining roads.
Interesting. The East-West Highway part of this?
I haven't considered the East-West Highway so much as I've tried to consider the possibility of purchasing 295 and 395, turn it over to the Maine Turnpike Authority. They do a good job maintaining a highway. I want to acknowledge the fact that 295 and 395 are similar highways and should be managed in a toll strategy, so it would free up money for DOT to start working on the secondary road system, which I think is critical.
All right. What about Maine's social welfare system? Is it too generous, or does it fall short?
There's a lot of folks struggling out there. I mean, as a Democrat, I've been trying to remind the party it's not a matter of getting a week's paycheck. It's recognizing the fact that for many people, a week's paycheck doesn't even go 5 days. So we need to provide support and sustenance. I think the strategy should be such that if you access a benefit package, it has to have a tail end that diminishes in relationship to your ability to increase your own wages. There are too many cliff options where if you have a job, you fall off aid from the state. And the reality is, for many in our population, being employed is a chronic issue. You're working a few months, then you're not working for the next few months. And a lot of positions that have opened up are lower paying service jobs. And I think that's why there's been such a big battle around minimum wage, was an attempt to say we recognize that deficiency in the economic structure and we're trying to push people up.
You know, I wonder, when it comes to welfare too, is there work to be done on the perception side? Governor LePage, other Republicans often talk about the able-bodied and the need for them to do more, to find jobs, to work harder.
I know they want people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. I'd rather purchase the boots first. I mean, that's the reality for some individuals. Able-bodied doesn't necessarily mean healthy or having the capacity to work. Able-bodied doesn't guarantee that the individual has skill sets to move into what is becoming more and more a technology-based economy, and that's the challenge. So I think welfare has to be tied intimately with training initiatives to prepare people to make that transition. And I think You don't get people to participate by demeaning them. We should be better than that. And that's the role of government, is to recognize those realities and act as a partner with the disadvantaged.
Voters overwhelmingly approved expanding Medicaid last year. And currently, of course, there's debate between the governor and the legislature over how to fund that. Do you support Medicaid expansion, and how should the state pay for it?
I do support Medicaid expansion, and I think the conversation always skips over quickly to Medicare for All. I think two things have to happen. An audit, so that we can assess the actual cost of health care in the state. And second, a strategy that would allow us to have a public option buy-in into main care. That would accomplish two things. We have an existing pool. We'd be expanding that. That should reduce the cost. Second, it would remove the stigma that main care is somehow welfare for the few, when it could be a benefit for the all. That's a strategy. As governor, I would also create a health care cost commission so that we can turn to the medical bureaucracy in the state and say, look, at the very least, we need to get a schedule of costs so we can assess why the price is what it is. I mean, right now, for the corporate side of this equation, they've sat back. They've enjoyed this conversation where we want to expand the pie, and we're not asking them why they're going to take a bigger slice. So that's what I have to do as governor first, is we can fund Medicare with the monies that we'd be paying for free care in the hospitals. We can begin that journey, public buy-in option, and then cost containment on hospitals and corporate medical practices.
Does the state pay its fair share of local education costs?
No. I think for the last 8 years, there's been a conscious retreat from providing the monies necessary through revenue sharing or aid to education. And here's the reality, and this is the third rail, but we have to touch it. We have to examine our revenue strategy. Tax cuts didn't come free. We need to reconsider those. I think we need progressive tax. Everybody needs to pay a fair share. We need to increase the revenue. We can't accomplish our agenda as Democrats without increasing the revenue available to meet those demands.
Yeah. Relatedly, Maine has a shortage of teachers. Is there anything the state could do to better incentivize people to go into that?
Pay them. Yeah. I mean, sometimes that's the easiest answer, is pay them for the responsibility and for the respect that we should have, because success in any other segment of our society, whether it's economic or otherwise, is predicated on a successful education experience. And we can't have that experience unless we recognize the true value of the professionals that deliver that education. We have to make that commitment. We can't just talk about it. We have to put hard dollars on the table. So I would raise the minimum wage for teachers to at least $40,000 a year.
Do you think Maine's referendum process is working the way it was intended? And if not, what should we do to change it?
I worked for the referendum team that passed the marijuana initiative. And we knew internally there were flaws in our proposal. But the essence of what we were trying to do, legalize cannabis, made sense. And then I've spent 18 months on the committee trying to develop the rules from that referendum. And there's always this talk that we've abandoned the will of the people. I think the will of the people was fundamentally an emotional question with the answer of yes or no as to whether or not the referendum should pass. I'm not quite as sure that the public was actually weighing in on the particulars of market licensing. And I think that's one of the flaws in the referendum process. There's probably some merit to having the participation of the legislature through a public hearing prior to the referendum going out. So at least some of these questions can be fleshed out. And I think that would provide much needed education to voters when that referendum goes to the polls.
What about the idea that in gathering signatures on citizen initiatives, there ought to be a kind of equal effort to gather them in the two congressional districts?
I don't know. I think that's kind of like a paper tiger. They say we need to go to the second district. I guess in my mind that means going about 30 miles up the road to Lewiston. I'm not sure what that accomplishes. I think if I was a proponent for that idea, I would probably say it should be predicated on a certain percentage from each county based on some index. At least that would be more straightforward, and I think it would accomplish what those advocates are trying to realize. But simply dividing it by first versus second district, as I said, I think it's a paper tiger, and it can be easily circumvented.
And in about 10 years, there may be no first and
That's
second
right.
district.
There's a possibility of that, a very real possibility.
Yeah. There's a working theory that the country is so polarized that it's best for elected officials to keep their supporters happy and loyal rather than try to reach compromise or build coalitions. Do you believe that's true?
Look, I've spent 8 years in the legislature, and I would hope that my reputation has been as a collaborator, as a problem solver. That's what we're intended to do. And you can accomplish that if you don't demonize the opposition. They were sent by their voters. They're respected by their voters. They have a valid perspective. Our challenge is to try to find a common language so we can get to agreement. It's not easy. It's hard work, but it's absolutely necessary. And I, for one, believe it should be our primary duty as a legislator. And that's why I said earlier that I think a governor has to be a moral political leader and strive to create that kind of context and environment that would reward collaboration.
Candidates for governor often talk about transparency in government. So how important is that to you? How much of what you would do as governor is the public entitled to know about? Where do you kind of draw those lines?
I've been in public service for 40 years now. Prior to going to the legislature, I was in criminal justice as a deputy chief of police here and as a sheriff, and we believed in transparency. I modeled that as a sheriff, even down to when we did something that we knew we'd be criticized for by the public. I told my staff, our primary responsibility at this juncture is to get out first, tell the story, invite scrutiny. That is the role of a public servant, is having a willingness and to demonstrate that willingness to invite the media or other interested parties into your decision-making process to evaluate that. So, no, it has to be an open door. You work for the public, so I can't see the basis for concluding that you should keep secrets from them.
All right. Beyond signing bills into law, how can a governor improve the lives of people in Maine?
As I said earlier, by being a moral leader, by calling right when you see it and taking wrong out into the public scrutiny when it's there, I think you have to reinforce when people are actually doing the right things. I think a governor has to leave Augusta, get back out on the street, and just be there to appreciate what people are doing. I think we've left an administration in the rearview mirror that did little of that. Your ability to have a positive relationship with state government isn't about the governor. It's about the clerk at the window at BMV, or the marshal in a courthouse, or the driver of a plow truck on the turnpike who's been told he's doing a good job. You have to make that kind of human contact. People need to feel respected and appreciated, and I think it's a responsibility of a governor to communicate that.
You talked a little bit earlier about some of the ways that you might approach road infrastructure improvements and funding for that. Are there any other ideas that you have for what this state needs in terms of improved infrastructure and how it should pay for it?
Well, we did talk about roads. I think the other piece, and I wasn't discounting it, but I was trying to see it in conjunction with the road system, is broadband. We are in the 21st century. It's clearly going to be more and more of an e-economy. I think we have to talk about the possibility that broadband should be considered as a public utility. And the reason for that, that type of public-private partnership would spur investment into those regions of the state where the return on investment, if we allow it to remain a private market operation, will sidestep and not be realized. I understand when a broadband market refuses to go into certain parts of the state. The population density is such, it doesn't make much sense. But if it was a utility and there was some corresponding value in a more competitive market for having assumed that responsibility by the private sector, they may be more inclined to make that investment, and I think it would create a positive, vicious cycle for the local economy.
Hmm. Lastly, in about a minute, what are Maine's three greatest assets, and how would you leverage those to improve the state's economy?
First of all, the people. I think we have a wonderful work ethic. In my years as sheriff, when I left Maine, it's one of the first things that federal officials or government officials would talk to me about is the fact that we always look for Maine people because they actually give us 150% every day. That's your reputation. So we need to inspire local leadership. Leadership is not going to occur solely in Augusta. I have to inspire people to take initiatives forward at the city, town, and county level. That's the first piece. The second, it's the quality of life in our environment. People don't come to Maine because they think they're going to make a lot of money, okay, when we have in-migration. They come here because they value this place like no other place. This is where they want their children to grow up, and I think that's critical. And third, our natural resources. One of the issues I've been talking about is water. Water could be Maine's oil of the future. How we determine the ownership of groundwater, its quality, what we say about policies regarding commercial extraction may in fact provide a return to Maine's economy that we're not prepared to answer today, but we need to be able to do that. So to summarize, people is number one. The quality of place equals quality of life, and an ongoing commitment to preserve our natural resources and recover an appropriate revenue stream for Maine citizens should those resources be taken out of state.
Mark Dion, one of seven Democrats in this year's gubernatorial primary. He spoke with Maine Public's Erwin Gratz. If you missed either of the interviews in this hour, you can hear all 14 conversations at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You can also learn more about each of the candidates and see their positions broken down on an easy-to-use issues grid near the top of our Your Vote page. I'm Keith Shortall. Thanks for listening.